This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani escaped an attack by the Taliban that killed scores of people. Reuters' Joe Davies has details on the not one but two attacks that occurred.
Taliban suicide bombers killed at least 48 people in two separate attacks on Tuesday in the wake of collapsed peace talks with the United States and just 11 days before Afghanistan's presidential elections. The deadliest took place in Charikar, the capital of central Parwan province, near an election rally held by President Ashraf Ghani. The Taliban have vowed to violently disrupt the poll. The blast killed 26 people. 42 more were injured.
When the people were entering the police camp, an old man riding a motorcycle arrived on the highway and detonated his explosives, causing casualties. His dead body remains on the ground.
In the capital, Kabul, more bloodshed. There, a man blew himself up, killing 22 people. Another 38 were wounded.
That is Reuters' Joe Davies reporting. There is growing evidence that a drone and missile attack launched against Saudi Arabian oil fields under the cover of darkness originated in Iran. Houthi rebels in Yemen, backed by Iran, originally claimed responsibility for Saturday's attack, knocking out half the country's oil production. But U.S. officials say the available evidence is showing that's not possible. Unnamed officials told NBC News on Tuesday that more than 20 drones and missiles used in the attack on the Saudi oil facilities were launched from Iran. Other officials told CBS News that at least one of the missiles flew through Kuwait's airspace as it headed south towards Saudi Arabia, with Reuters quoted officials as saying the attacks originated in southwestern Iran. This is VOA News. The Air Force and Navy bought Chinese-manufactured drones for elite forces months after the Pentagon prohibited their use due to cybersecurity concerns. In each case, the services used special exemptions granted by the Pentagon's Acquisition and Sustainment Office on a case-by-case basis. Exit polls in Israel's national election show that neither Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nor challenger and former Army head Benny Gantz can put together a ruling coalition. Both sides hope the results will change as votes are counted during the night and into the morrow. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The exit polls were announced at 10 p.m. just as the polls closed in Israel. Based on all three exit polls, Netanyahu is not able to form a majority coalition of 61 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Likud cabinet minister Tzachi Hanegbi said he believed Netanyahu's chances will improve as the final votes are counted. He said he still believes Netanyahu has the best chance of forming a government. Once final results are in, Netanyahu's president will consult with the leaders of each of the parties and recommend either Netanyahu or Gantz to try to put together a government. So far, it doesn't look like either the right wing or the center-left will be able to do that. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The first hearing on what House Democrats are calling an impeachment investigation quickly went awry. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
Starting with the first question from House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler.
Is it correct that as reported in the Mueller report on June 19, 2017, you met alone in the Oval Office with the president?
Former Trump campaign chief Corey Lewandowski set the tone.
Could you read the exact language of the report, sir? I don't have it available to me.
Lewandowski says the White House ordered him not to talk about his discussions with the president beyond what's in the Mueller report.
I am respecting the White House's decision.
Nadler says the White House doesn't have that authority.
We should call this what it is. An absolute cover-up by the White House.
Lewandowski earlier blasted lawmakers for going down a rabbit hole with petty politics, drawing the president's attention. He tweeted from Air Force One, such a beautiful opening statement. Thank you, Corey. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Prominent Hong Kong activists behind the months of protests were in Washington Tuesday to urge U.S. lawmakers to support a Hong Kong protester leader Joshua Wong and Hong Kong celebrity activist Denise Ho were part of a panel appealing for U.S. support during testimony before the Congressional Executive Commission on China. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Two political outsiders are going for a runoff election in Tunisia.
At the end, I think I'm happy about the results because I think that we are back to 8 years ago challenging the status quo, and I think he is the voice of the revolution.
That's Tunisian social entrepreneur Wala Kasmi. The first group of Namibian refugees were deported Tuesday from Botswana. Human rights violations in Burundi have surged in run-up to the 2020 elections. A Liberian radio talk show host admits receiving $5,000 from President George Weah. Is he a journalist or a businessman? And the DRC Supreme Court orders house arrest for former Health Minister Ole Ilunga.
He was in custody since Saturday, and today the Supreme Court decided to put him in house arrest. Now he's out and house arrest.
Guy Kabeya is the lawyer for former Health Minister Ole Ilunga. A UN rapporteur visits Zimbabwe to assess human rights situation there. And a Rwandan court sentences a Kenyan national for fraud. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisia's Independent Electoral Commission on Tuesday confirmed the stunning victories of two political outsiders in the first round of presidential voting. As Lisa Bryan reports from Tunis, the results are seen as a major rebuff of the post-revolution political establishment.
Final results place law professor Kais Saied and business tycoon Nabil Karoui in first and second place, respectively, capturing more than 18% and 16% of the vote. They now face a runoff in what is Tunisia's second only free and democratic presidential election. But the bigger story may be the losers, starting with Prime Minister Youssef Chahed, who received just over 7% of the vote. Defense Minister Abdel Karim Sbidi also scored in the single digits. Turnout was less than 50%, another marker of voter disaffection. Tunisian journalist Tariq Mami of France Maghreb 2 Radio says Tunisians got rid of one system during the revolution, that of autocratic president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Now they're getting rid of the system that replaced him. Widespread corruption and soaring food prices helped to fuel voter anger. Saied and Karoui have one thing in common. Both are newcomers when it comes to running for office. Both kept low physical profiles during campaigning these past weeks, but for different reasons. Karoui was jailed in August on corruption allegations, a move his supporters claim was politically motivated. Saied rejected state election funds in large rallies, favoring door-to-door campaigning. Saied is a social conservative and a frequent legal commentator on television. Karoui scored points with the poor for his foundation's charitable works.
But at the end, I think I'm happy about the not full results, but about the results, because I think that we are back to 8 years ago challenging the status quo and claiming new models, a new system. And I think he is the voice of the revolution.
Social entrepreneur Wala Kasmi didn't vote for Saied and was surprised by the results.
But at the end, I think I'm happy about the not full results, but about the results, because I think that we are back to 8 years ago challenging the status quo and claiming new models, a new system. And I think he is the voice of the revolution.
Construction worker Hussein calls Saied a good man. He says Saied knows the law. He's honest. He will invest a lot in the country. He has good ideas. Hussein says he doesn't know much about Karoui. This is only the first round in the election season. October's legislative vote comes next, offering another test of whether Tunisians will continue to sanction the political establishment. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
The Democratic Republic of Congo Supreme Court on Tuesday ordered house arrest for former Health Minister Ali Ilunga. He had been in jail since last Saturday following his arrest for alleged mismanagement of $4.3 million of Ebola response money. The government said Ilunga was planning on fleeing the country to neighboring Congo Brazzaville to avoid trial. Guy Kabaye Muana Kalala, one of Ilunga's lawyers, says the former health minister has denied any wrongdoing.
His position is that every document about found is in the account in the document, and the prosecutor has that document. And I cannot display the strategy of defense here, of course, but his position is clear. He denies any wrongdoing in the matter about this appropriation of public funds from Ebola.
So what happened to the money, as the government alleges?
They are saying that the money wasn't used for Ebola or used for everything else. That's what they are saying. And you know that in that case, as we are in legal process, we are waiting for the evidence against him, and we will fight evidence against evidence.
What does he make of the government decision to remove him?
No, the government didn't remove him. He decided himself to resign. He displayed his letter of the resignation and public. I think this question must be asked to him directly. Me, I'm just a lawyer about the prosecution against him.
Where is Dr. Ilunga himself? Is he in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Yes, he was in custody since Saturday. And today, the Supreme Court, we call it here Cour de Cassation, the highest court in DRC, but the judiciary matters, decided to put him in house arrest. Now, I'm speaking to you now, out and house arrest now.
The government said he was arrested because he wanted to leave the country. Is that true?
No, he denies the wrong, strong view. That, first of all, they caught him while he was a resident in Gombe. Gombe is the downtown in Kinshasa. And police said first that he was trying to move to Brazzaville from Congo Central. Congo Central is really far from Gombe. And where they caught him in downtown, it was not about flying or something like that. And, now he's under house arrest.
So you said the minister is under house arrest. When will he go to court?
As he's in the house arrest, there is police around his house. Anytime the prosecutor can invite him, he will be available. Now he's available, of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Guy Kabeye Muana Kalala is one of the lawyers for former DRC Health Minister Ali Ilunga. He was speaking with us from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. The Commission of Inquiry on Burundi says human rights abuses are increasing against political opponents of President Pierre Nkurunziza in the run-up to the May 2020 presidential and parliamentary elections. These include extrajudicial executions, disappearances, arbitrary arrests, torture, and sexual violence. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report finds sympathizers of opposition parties, journalists, and human rights defenders are among those targeted for abuse. The investigators have documented violations committed mainly in rural and remote areas during night attacks on households. It says attacks are usually carried out by the Imbonerakure, the youth wing of the ruling party. The chair of the Commission of Inquiry, Dudu Dien, says agents from the National Intelligence Service, or SNR, and the police also are involved in violations cases. He says some of the violations, including murder, imprisonment, rape, and political persecution, probably constitute crimes against humanity. Under the new 2018 constitution, he notes the SNR is no longer under the authority of the government and the civilian oversight of parliament. He speaks through an interpreter.
It now falls solely under the direct authority and control of the President of the Republic, who therefore can be held criminally accountable for the actions of the National Intelligence Service, the SNR agents.
The report finds civil liberties, freedom of expression and association have become severely restricted. Cameroonian Commission member Lucy Aswagbor says the judicial system continues to be used as an instrument of repression against political opponents, as well as being used by the executive for political purposes.
After 4 years of crisis and on the eve of the 2020 elections, the situation in Burundi is characterized by the persistence of the 2015 crisis, as demonstrated in particular by economic instability, the presence of more than 340,000 Burundian refugees in neighboring countries, overall impunity, and the lack of prospects of a political solution to the crisis.
Burundi's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Renova Tabu, rejects the report, calling it deceitful, defamatory, and politically motivated. He accuses the commission of presenting the views of the opposition and vows that his government will never give in to politically biased intimidation. He says the people of Burundi will conduct next year's elections in a tranquil atmosphere. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, September 18th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. UN Special Rapporteur Clement Voule is in Zimbabwe this week on a 10-day visit to assess the human rights situation there. Voule's visit takes place at a time when rights groups are worried about abductions and disappearances of activists and have taken to the streets to protest. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
This is the first official visit by an independent human rights expert to Zimbabwe, where rights groups have on several occasions accused the government of committing abuses. Clemente Valeu was appointed by the UN Human Rights Council.
And I'm here at the invitation of the government of Zimbabwe to conduct a country visit regarding my mandate, which is to assess the implementation and the protection of the right to freedom of association, peaceful assembly in the country.
His trip comes as doctors and nurses in Zimbabwe hold vigils and protests to call attention to the disappearance of Peter Gabriel Magombeyi, acting president of the Zimbabwe Doctors Association. The doctors say their leader was abducted from his home over the weekend for leading an industrial action against the government over their salaries, which amount to under $200 a month. Health Minister Obadiah Moyo denied Harare's involvement in the disappearance.
For now, we have said as doctors, let's down our tools until Peter comes back, because our own security as doctors is not guaranteed. If they took Peter, what will stop them from taking one of us again?
Douglas Coulthard with the group Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says his organization is convinced that the government might be responsible for the spate of abductions targeting activists.
We've now had 51 abductions just this year. It's a massive concern, and all of these abductions are following similar modus operandi, where people come, typically men masked, using military-grade weapons such as AK-47s, breaking into people's homes, abducting them, torturing them. It's a huge concern.
Valeu is expected to present a preliminary report on his findings next week, Friday. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The first group of more than 800 Namibian refugees was deported Tuesday from Botswana after resisting calls for voluntary repatriation. The refugees fled their home country in 1999 following a secessionist uprising. The migrants had refused to return home, citing fears of persecution from Namibian authorities. Kundisi Dube reports from Habaroni.
On Tuesday morning, 94 refugees, including a one-year-old child, were transported back home. The more than 800 refugees are being forced to return home after they declined pleas for voluntary repatriation from the Botswana and Namibian governments. A spokesperson for the refugees, Felix Kakula, says despite the deportations, they will not be silenced and will continue to advocate for a separate state.
At the event that we are deported back to Namibia, they should inform the Namibian government that people who are being deported are members of the United Democratic Party, such that they should open their prisons and lock us in, because we are not going to keep it quiet when we are there.
Most refugees are members of the secessionist party, the United Democratic Party, which remains banned in Namibia. Kakula, together with other Namibian refugees, were declared illegal immigrants after they refused to register for voluntary repatriation at the end of August. One refugee who requested anonymity says the homes they left two decades ago have been destroyed.
We do not have a place to call home. Since we have been away from home for the past 2 decades, those homes that we had, they are not there anymore.
She says some of the students were born in Botswana and have never been to Namibia had their studies disrupted at a time they were preparing for examinations in October.
We were not given anything without any paper transfers for their children, anything concerning their future education. And you can imagine the children who are not given anything, the children who were born here in Botswana, they are treated like foreign thing and they are supposed to go to school. Others were to write.
Human rights group Tswanelo has called for dialogue on the matter, particularly the plight of children who were removed from schools. But efforts to engage both governments has hit a snag. The Namibian government has said it is safe for the refugees to return, but it has vowed to deal with those who identify themselves as separatists. Nkondisi Dube for VOA News, Aboroni.
There is a question trending in the Liberian social media about popular radio talk show host Henry Costa, a fierce critic of President George Weah's government, who admits accepting $5,000 in 2018 to promote government policy. Costa says he is a businessman and not a journalist. But in its editorial, the Bush Chicken publication asks, how does accepting money from President Weah fits into Costa's argument that the president is corrupt when he, Costa, is also benefiting from President Weah's alleged corruption? Costa says the $5,000 was a gift and not a bribe. Besides, he says he accepted the money long before what he calls the Weah government's many alleged incidences of glaring corruption.
I had gone home to visit, and on my way back to the U.S. on that day, the president called me and said he was sending his special aid to me with a small travel token. And the special aid came to me, Seko Kalasko Damaro, and presented to me an envelope. When I opened it, and he said it was $5,000. This was the president's little way of saying, travel well, my friend. I accepted the token because it was not a bribe. It was a gift. And I am not a journalist. I am a political commentator. This is a well-established fact.
Mr. Costa, did you see the editorial written by the Bush Chicken?
Yeah, I only saw it after it was mentioned to me not so long ago.
Let me ask you, because this is what they said. How does accepting money fit into your argument that President Weah and his government are corrupt?
Mr. Bode, this was 6 months when President Weah had just been in power for 6 months. This was long before we saw the condominiums go up. This was long before we had the allegations of the MAPOP exercise. This is long before everything else happened. $5,000. It was not a bribe. It was a gift. Then one of the corrections that I like to make, that the Bush Chicken clearly gets it wrong, is that I'm a journalist. I'm not a journalist. And you know that, as well as everyone who has heard me say it repeatedly. I am a talk show host and a political commentator. Accepting a token from a president that I was supporting 6 months into his infant administration, long before all the rumors and speculations, and of course, apparently glaring evidences of corruption were unearthed or revealed. To me, there's nothing unethical about that, Mr. Botte.
So you are not a journalist, you are a talk show host. And
That
how you earn your living?
Mr. Botte, that is not how I earn my living. Giving me a token, clearly no one knows when the token is going to come. So you cannot plan your livelihood around a token, for it is not reliable. I'm a businessman. I own a radio station and I own a startup company here in the U.S. and I own another small business in Liberia that I would not like to divulge what that is, because I already deal with too much pushbacks from the government regarding the radio station.
As you know, in Liberia, there's this argument that, in fact, if it's not the brown envelope journalism, is another. So can you talk to journalists in Liberia, if you can, about implications of the importance of a journalist being independent of the news they cover?
Oh, yeah, that's a key factor. Mr. Botte, it's a difficult thing. You see, many journalists are easily compromised because they don't make a lot, and sometimes it's difficult to resist the temptations. Let me give you an example. When I was on my way to Liberia for the June 7th protest, which I called, the government sent an emissary to meet with me in Ghana, and they offered me $200,000, Mr. Botte, for me to take the money and pretend that I was sick and could not reach to Liberia for the protest. I announced this on the radio as well. Well, the Bush Chicken didn't write about it then, because that was something ethical, right? Because if I had taken that $200,000, that would have been a bribe. It would have been unethical of me to do that. But not everybody is able to resist that sort of thing, Mr. Bote, because times are very tough and journalists don't get paid very well.
But that doesn't excuse any journalist to accept money from newsmakers.
It does not. It does not. If you call a press conference in Liberia, you have to give them money. We do that all the time. Whenever the Council of Patriots, of which I'm chairman, the movement I call the June 7th protest, whenever we call a press conference, we have to give them a minimum of $200, U.S. dollars. That's what you do in Liberia. That is the culture. Doesn't mean it is right, but that is the culture.
So you do not feel now that you have been compromised in your effort to be critical of the We Are government?
Mr. Bote, this was 6 months into his administration. In November of the same year, 2018, I would withdraw my support from the government. I have been critical ever since. This was long before I, together with others, organized the largest protest in the country's history. Right now, we are planning and calling for a second protest to be staged in December.
Mr. Costa, thank you very much for a candid discussion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bote. Always a pleasure.
That was Liberian political commentator and popular radio talk show host Henry Costa. He was speaking with us from the U.S. state of Delaware. A court in Rwanda Monday sentenced a Kenyan, Charles Kinituya, to 2 years in prison and fined him 3 million Rwandan franc, about $3,268, after finding him guilty of fraud. Kinutia's three co-accused, two Kenyans and a Rwandan, were acquitted. Eugene Iwimana has details from Kigali.
The judge in the Kichuchiro Primary Court said there was enough evidence of fraud in Kinutia's conference. Worth Fitness, the company that Dr. Charles Kinutia owns, organized the conference in question. The prosecution calls the conference a scam that promised attendants $197, but paradoxically, attendants were the ones to pay entrance fees. The judge said that Kinutia should have written his invitation to Rwandans about the conference clearly in a way that did not promise take-home bonuses and should have avoided messages telling attendants that seats were limited to first payers. The court also found that since Kinutia's doctorate degree is in humanities, he did not have the expertise in training people about job creation. Kinutia and the other three suspects were arrested in June and charged with fraud and convening an illegal meeting which drew thousands of Rwandans, mainly youth, who were expecting to get money and entrepreneurship skills. The arrest of the Kenyans generated considerable attention on social media, with many Kenyans urging the Rwandan government to release Kinutia and his colleagues. But Rwandan President Paul Kagame said social media is not the judiciary. After seeing the crowd of people, he prepared bags where they had to fill in money, and they did it, even the ones who had no coin apart from borrowing. And he was arrested. I was following on social media, people claiming you have to release them. Social media is not the judiciary. According to the prosecution, the organizers have pocketed more than 4 million Rwandan francs and $680 from about 2,500 people who showed up at the Kigali Confession Center. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tunisia's Independent Electoral Commission Tuesday confirmed the stunning victories of two political outsiders in the first round of presidential voting. The results are seen as a major rebuff of the post-revolutionary political establishment. And the Democratic Republic of Congo Supreme Court Tuesday ordered house arrest for former Health Minister Oli Ilunga. He had been in jail since last Saturday following his arrest for alleged mismanagement of $4.3 million of Ebola response money. And that is it for this Wednesday, September 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.